Case number 21-3075, United States of America versus Eleanor R. Milligan, appellant. Mr. Hicks for the appellant, Mr. Hahn for the appellate.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Hicks, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, your honors, and may it please the court, George Hicks for appellant Eleanor Milligan. There is no dispute in this case as Ms. Milligan never put intent or mistake at issue, as her counsel candidly told the district court, quote, we are not contesting intent or lack of mistake. And he added, quote, it's just not a live question. Accordingly, the 404B other act evidence regarding Ms. Milligan's uncharged conduct that the government introduced specifically to establish intent and lack of mistake had no probative value. And like all 404B evidence, it was prejudicial because it conveyed to the jury Ms. Milligan's propensity to engage in the conduct that was actually charged. But the prejudice was even more pronounced than in a typical 404B case for several reasons.
What counsel said at trial, but pre-trial, the district judge asked if he was prepared to stipulate intent. He said no. He said very clearly, he said, quote, let me be very clear. I'm not stipulating to intent or lack of mistake.
Your Honor, counsel made that statement during the pretrial conference when the motion was first being heard on July 9th. Later, during trial on July 21st, he made very clear that they were not, Ms. Milligan was not contesting. He said, we're not contesting, we're not making that argument. It's just not a live question. And I think the salient question for purposes of this analysis about trying to determine what the probative value is and what the prejudice might be on the other side of the balance is whether the purpose for which the other act evidence is introduced is actually at issue. The Seventh Circuit makes that very clear in its Gomez case en banc, where it says an important issue in the Rule 403 balancing is the extent to which the non-propensity factual proposition actually is contested in the case. It later says the degree to which the non-propensity issue actually is disputed in the case will affect the probative value of the other act evidence. And I think even the district court understood that on July 21st, because he doesn't phrase his decision in terms of there being a formal stipulation or not. He refers to the defendant, quote, passing on contesting the issue in a live way at trial. And I think that makes the difference here, at least when you're looking at the probative value. I mean, the government's motion was premised on the proposition that intent and mistake were at issue. And by the time of July 21st, it was made clear to all, both the district court and the government, that that was not the case. She was not putting on a defense.
What do you mean? I mean, no criminal defendant has to put on any defense at all, but that doesn't mean that the elements are not at issue and that they have to be found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And so intent was still, or the mens rea was still very much at issue, and that the government had to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to each and every single juror.
Well,
so
certainly,
it's still a live issue. It's very much a live issue with a very heavy burden on the government.
Well, certainly it's still the government's burden to prove all that, but that would be the case in any situation where you've got 404B. And so I think that that would not be entirely consistent with the cases that say when the other act evidence is used for a purpose, whether it's
not at issue. The probative need remains from the government's perspective, from its burden. The need for probative evidence to establish intent remains. So I don't quite understand saying intent was not a live issue, just that the defendant chose to stay quiet on that issue.
Well,
there's no stipulation to hand to the jury.
There's no stipulation, but I think that when you're trying to determine the marginal probative value, which I think really is the question here, it's not simply sort of probative value, qua probative value, it's the marginal probative value of that other act evidence over what's already in the case and what the government would need in order to surmount some sort of defense that raises intent. And I think that's shown by the government's case.
That's a different argument. That's a different argument, that there's what evidence is already in the case. But I was struggling with your it's not a live issue and what it seems to me it very much is. But the marginal probative value relative to other evidence in the case, that feels to me like a different argument than just saying something's not an issue, a live issue.
Well, I think the when you're trying to determine what the marginal probative value is, you have to look at the extent to which it actually is contested in the case beyond simply, well, it's an element, therefore it's always at issue. I mean, I think that's clear from the case that the government cites, almost all of which involve the defense putting on a defense.
So there was evidence before the jury that went to the question of mistake. It came from the government. The government put it on, but at least the government adduced testimony that raised it. But there was evidence before the jury from which the jury could have thought about the question of mistake.
I think there was one passing statement that was, as you say, put on by the government. So it seems a little backwards to me that the government can put on testimony that somehow allows them to then put the.
But you don't think that the government put on that testimony so that they could introduce the 404B evidence, or do you?
No, I don't think so. But I think it was a hook that they then tried to use. And to be very clear, while we think that the marginal probative value of this was quite low, if anything at all, when you look at the other side of the balance, I think the prejudice was significant. I mean, there's no dispute that 404B evidence is always prejudicial. That's the nature of it. There's no dispute that it's even more prejudicial when it's introduced for intent, as it was here in part. And it's even more prejudicial when the other act evidence is similar in nature to the charged offense. That's what we have here. And it was, in fact, almost right afterward in time as well. And to be very clear, the other act evidence in this case was extensive. It was over 60 pages of the trial transcript. That's at JA 172 to 232. These were the last witnesses, and it was the last evidence that the jury heard before closing argument and deliberation and instructions. And I think that the prejudice that it's clear is shown by the fact that the district court's analysis of the prejudice, I don't think the government even defends. The district court's explanation for why there was no prejudice here was that, well, the charged crime involved allegations of $1.5 million in funds, whereas the other act evidence only involved $55,000. And I don't think that's the right way to look at the prejudice of other act evidence. The salient question is, what was the conduct? Was the conduct similar in kind and nature? And we have that here. It was very similar conduct. It was almost just a year or two after the charged conduct. And I think the takeaway from that for any jury would be to focus highly on the propensity evidence.
Can I ask a following question? So if the piece of evidence that we were talking about earlier where a mistake comes up, if that's adduced in cross-examination by defense counsel, not in a direct question that asks about it, but in a question that asks about something else and the witness just volunteers that, would your assessment of the balance here change?
I think it would change if that was part of the strategy of defense to on cross-examination, but I think that
no, so let's suppose it's not part of the strategy. It just comes up in cross-examination. Wasn't planned, wasn't intended. It's a question that doesn't directly ask about it, but the witness volunteers it in response to the question.
I don't think it would affect the analysis too much, again, because I think it is directed towards what the defendant is trying to put at issue in his or her defense. And if I could...
Mr. Hicks, let's assume you're right about that. The government makes a pretty strong argument that the error would be harmless. And the evidence is only Milliken could access the paycheck system, and her supervisor. Her supervisor testified that he never did. She took funds in the name of several employees and deposited them in one bank account completely controlled by her. And then she took steps to cover her tracks. So why isn't this pretty clearly harmless?
Well, Judge Tittle, with respect, I think those are very good arguments to make to a jury on a retrial without the aspect that was included.
Well, no, there are questions we ask also.
Well, I don't think this court necessarily, and I think this court is clear, doesn't step into the shoes of the jury.
No, but you agree that we do apply harmless error analysis to a case like this, right?
Sure. I think you're trying to decide whether the government has shown.
Well, that's inherent in any harmless error analysis that we undertake. Right?
Yes, but I think also inherent in that is to look
as you said, we're intruding on the right of the jury, then we would never engage in a harmless error analysis.
Well, I think what you do is you look at the nature of the prejudice that is trying to be addressed through the harmlessness error. And again, I think this goes beyond the mine run of cases where you've got just sort of mere 404B standard prejudice for the reasons.
Right. Let me just quickly change subjects for you and ask you quickly about the sophisticated means enhancement, which you challenge. Assume that I think we apply a due deference standard here. Just assume that for purposes of the question. What explanation would I give for setting aside the enhancement here, given the evidence of the cover? How would I say I wouldn't give due deference to the district court's decision, particularly since the district court, they see these all the time. We don't.
Well, Your Honor, I think that if you're asking sort of what are the reasons that the sophisticated
I'm not asking that question. The question I'm asking is, let's assume I agree with you. This, to me, doesn't look very sophisticated, but the district court thought it was. And I owe due deference to the district court's assessment of that issue. So what would I say to set aside that his judgment on?
How would I explain
that I can't defer to him? What's the rest of the sentence? We can't defer to the district court in this case because what's the rest of the sentence?
I think it would be the same because that you use in your other abuse of discretion cases, Your Honor, which is that this would be finding the sophisticated means here would be beyond the range of a reasonable decision in light of the utter lack of sophistication that was inherent here.
You just stated the conclusion, the utter lack of sophistication. Sophistication can mean one thing to one person and something to someone else. But I ask the question this way. Let's assume I thought it was a close case. That is, you can make the argument either way, sophisticated, not sophisticated. In other words, it wasn't clear one way or the other. Don't I have to defer to the district court on that ground?
Your Honor, I think if it was a close question, I think that then the standard of review would come into play, as you say. Yeah. But I think that when it is not, when the text of the sentencing requirements say especially complex, I think especially means something or especially intricate. I think you have to give some meaning to the word especially. And I don't think setting up a different email accounts or going and getting a PO box, and promptly getting caught is especially complex. I mean, I think I would use
The fact that she got quickly caught doesn't mean it wasn't sophisticated, right? Not really related to each other.
Well, I don't think this is a situation where there was some sort of years-long hiding of anything that would be indicative.
Where do you find that standard in the guidelines?
I think that is indicative of something that would be especially complex or especially intricate, fictitious, creating corporate shells. Uh-huh. I mean, I think when you look at that and you're trying to determine what sort of thing is especially intricate in a fraud.
Well, isn't that what she did?
She did not create any corporate entities. She did not create any fictitious entities. She just put it, said.
Why isn't that sophisticated?
I think that they're.
So you think the distinction is between the fact that she didn't really set up this realty company, but only called it one on paper. That's the difference between sophistication and not sophistication.
Your Honor, if I had to describe something as utterly not sophisticated, I think it would be this.
Thank you.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you. This time, we'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. Mr. Hahn, from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Brian Hahn for Appellee of the United States. The trial court in this case did not abuse its discretion in admitting the University of Maryland Medical System, or UMMS, evidence. The trial court correctly recognized that under this court's precedent, under Rule 404B, even if appellant had offered to stipulate to the element of specific intent to defraud, that that would not prevent the government from admitting this evidence under Rule 404B, so long as it went to a non-propensity issue, in this case, intent or lack of mistake or accident. The trial court also did not abuse its discretion in conducting the Rule 403 balancing in this case and determining that the UMMS evidence, the unfair prejudice of it, did not substantially outweigh its probative.
Where did the district court do the 403 balancing? Essentially said it comes in because it's probative and it was less money. But it never, or maybe you can tell me where, it talked about what the Supreme Court and Old Chief called the relative probative value of adding this other piece of evidence on top of all the evidence that was already in the mix. Where did it do that?
Yeah, so I think that on page 291 to 292 of the July 21st transcript is where the trial court specifically undergoes the 403 balancing. And I think I agree with Your Honor.
Sorry, which day page are you on?
I'm on page 291, the July 21st transcript. And I think I agree with the court that the trial court doesn't specifically say, you know, this is what the specific probative value here is. But the court does recognize that the evidence is of a probative value to intent and lack of mistake or accident.
Sorry, I don't have a 291. My appendix goes up into 240.
In the JA, do you have the JA page?
I'm sorry, I don't have the JA page. I apologize, Your Honor.
Okay, sorry. Remind me which date, then, so I'm at the right one.
Is it in the, are the pages you're referring to in the appendix?
I am not sure of that, Your Honor, actually, so I apologize. I only have the transcript citation in front of me. I think that...
Read me what the judge said?
I don't have the specific quotation, Your Honor.
We don't have the pages and we don't have the language.
So I don't have the JA pages and I mm-hmm. don't have the quotation in front of me. But what the trial court does say is that...
It looks like it's in the supplemental appendix, pages 111 to 112.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I appreciate that help. What the trial court does say is that the government still has the burden of proof in proving intent, that it's also probative of mistake or lack of accident, because there was testimony in the case that appellant told her bosses at GMSI when they noticed that there were some payments to David Morgan that shouldn't have been paid out, that it must have been a mistake or accident in terms of, I think what she said was that she had accessed the system in order to, someone asked her to access the system and it must have accidentally started the payments over again. And I think that particularly when you're looking at the UMMS evidence, both the fact that it is close in time and that the scheme is very similar to the GMSI evidence lends probative value to it for intent in this case.
I just want to get back to, I understand that argument. I'm trying to get back to whether the district court did the balancing that 403 requires under precedent like Old Chief.
Sure.
And that is not, does this have probative value and is it too prejudicial? It's because if it doesn't have probative value, it's not even relevant, so it doesn't get to come in. So that's not really doing anything on that side. And the Supreme Court spent a lot of time talking about you need to analyze relative probative value, or what your friend calls marginal probative value. The Supreme Court's words were relative probative value. And so did the district court do that? And if so, where?
So with the district court says specifically is that it is considering the fact that appellant did not, you know, avoided the issue of specific intent in cross-examination and says that
I'm talking about all the other evidence in the record.
Sorry.
As I read the district court, when counsel for Ms. Milligan said, you need to look at marginal probative value, district court said, no, I don't. That's not the test. So did not seem to engage in this analysis.
I think I disagree. I think what the trial court says is that it recognizes, the trial court does recognize that the fact that appellant did not, you know, make a full-throated defense, did not cross-examine witnesses based on the issue of specific intent, does affect the probative value and might do so in a marginal way, but that it did affect the court's view of the probative. And I don't know of any precedent, Your Honor, that suggests that the trial court needs to explicitly lay out every single piece or factor in the Rule 403 analysis when making its decision. I think that the record just has to reflect that the court, in fact, did do a proper 403 analysis. And I think it does so here because the trial court does, in fact, reference the fact that appellant's way of trying the case does affect what the trial court views as the probative value of the evidence. And then the trial court goes on to view the unfair prejudice. And again, I don't think the trial court explicitly talks about what the unfair prejudice is. I think everyone sort of knows what the unfair propensity prejudice is from 404B evidence. But the trial court says, look, the amount of money that was taken from UMMS is much lower than it's about $55,000, I believe, much lower than the over $1.5 million that was defrauded from GMSI. And therefore, its unfair prejudice is lessened because of that.
I'm not sure I completely follow that, because the prejudice, it seems to me, the potential prejudice comes not from the amount of the fraud, but from the fact of it. It's that this is the type of stuff this person has done before, ergo, they probably did it this time too. And the fact that last time they might not have gotten as much money, yeah, I mean, you could sort of look at it in some abstract way and said, boy, that troubles me at level A, it might trouble me at level B if the fraud had been even more successful. But really the work is being done not by the amount that's ultimately gained, but by the pattern of conduct, no?
So I think I agree that there is some unfair prejudice inherent in the fact that the scheme is the same, that the conduct is the same. I think that as you, I think, just said, that you might care about it more or less, A or B, on those different levels, depending on the amount of money that was taken. And certainly if we were trying to bring in evidence of the GMSI's fraudulent scheme in a trial for charging appellant with defrauding UMMS, I think that the amount of money would affect the unfair prejudice analysis there, because I do think that when a jury looks at the amount of money that's taken, if it is extremely large amount versus a much smaller amount, I think that does affect the prejudice.
But then the jury sitting there looking at the evidence, aren't they saying, do I think this person is guilty of the offense? I don't know that they'd say, I think it's less likely the person is guilty of the offense because the last time they did it, they didn't get that much money.
Well, so I think that it's the question is how prejudicial it is in terms of, like, can we attribute sort of bad character to this person, right? It's the unfair propensity inference. And
propensity to engage in the criminal conduct.
Right, but
engaged in, even if it wasn't.
Yes, but I do think.
Form weren't quite as juicy.
Yes, but I do think that more serious criminal conduct is more prejudicial than less serious criminal conduct, is really all we're saying. That's part of what the trial court's analysis was here. I do want to say that even if this court believes that the Rule 403 evidence was admitted improperly, that in this case it was harmless. There was substantial evidence that appellant specifically intended to defraud GMSI. There were many payments made to her bank account in the names of many different employees over the course of several years, and that when her bosses noticed the discrepancies with David Morgan's payments, she engaged in this very sophisticated cover-up scheme in order to throw them off her scent and allowed her to perpetuate the scheme for additional years. And so I do think that, and in addition, the trial court gave a very detailed and specific instruction on how the jury was to use the evidence. And of course, the government referred to it once and referred to it in conjunction with the the instruction that the court gave.
This is kind of the irony, is because under 404, the government's argument is, we need this evidence. And then we get to harmless error and they go, we didn't need it. We had so much other evidence. And that this really wouldn't have mattered to the jury anyhow. And that's exactly the type of upfront inquiry that the district court was supposed to undertake when it did 403 balancing. So it seems like the defendant's kind of in a catch 22 here. If it argues the balancing and the district court says, as it did, I don't think that's the test and I'm not going to do it, then they're never going to get it overturned because the government's going to turn around and say, we had so much evidence, this didn't really matter at all. How can the government say both things at the same time?
Yeah, so I think two things, Your Honor. First, I would say that the inquiry at the front end isn't whether or not the government needs the evidence, whether it's necessary for the government's case, of course. It's whether or not the evidence is probative and whether or not it's unfair prejudice.
No, it's more than just whether it's probative. That's the relevance inquiry. Well, it is whether it's relative probative value. That is in the scheme of the evidence presented. And that's why the district court wisely waited here until the government had put on, most of its case in chief. And so now I see what you've got. Now I see the sort of semi-truck loads of evidence that you have brought in on this issue and nothing really pushing it back from the other side. What is the value of putting this in? And the government there says, we still need it. So that the jury will understand that it really was intent and not mistake. But then you can't turn around at a harmless error stage and go, we didn't need it. It didn't matter to show intent or absence of mistake. That's what I'm wrestling.
Yeah. And I think, Your Honor, again, I would say that the inquiry isn't whether or not the evidence is necessary for the government's case. I think the inquiry
is the difference between necessary and having relative probative value. That is probative value within additional probative value.
Yeah.
Within the context of the case.
Yeah. And I think the
government said at the 404 stage that we don't need it. We've got plenty to win on this record, but we'd like it. And there was prejudice. The district court would almost necessarily abuse its discretion by letting it in if the government says, we don't need it. We'd like to have it just to tie a bow on this. But that's sort of the argument that's made at the harmless error stage.
So we think the additional probative value of the evidence is that it's different in kind than the other evidence that was admitted to show her lack of her specific intent. You've got the evidence of the scheme and how broad it is. You've got evidence of the cover-up. And then now you have additional evidence in the 404B evidence that she did a similar scheme later, about a year later. And then also that when she goes through her exit interview, I'll call it her exit interview, with UMMS, that, while she doesn't specifically admit to wrongdoing, she does apologize for what happened. She offers to repay the money, and she offers some sort of reasons why she might have needed the money. Husband died, her son, she needs to pay for her son's college. And so that, I think, Your Honor, is different in kind and sort of has a different probative effect than the other evidence in the case. And that's why it's admissible under Rule 404B and Rule 403, and still can be, if erroneously admitted, harmless in the context of this case.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions. Yeah, please.
If there are any questions about that.
I wanted to ask about the enhancement.
Of course.
How do you define complex?
I think I would define complex as something that it's hard to not use the same words like the guideline uses the word intricate, I think, and complex and things like that. I think that.
Sorry, it says intricate separate from complex.
Yeah, so what does
complex mean?
I think complex is sort of like, it's complicated. It is something that is...
It's harder than normal?
Yes. I would say that it's harder than normal.
Right, right. More, and well, and more maybe thought than normal.
Yeah.
A big stone can be harder than moving a little stone, but this requires...
Right.
Complex, I think, requires some sort of...
Right, some sort of...
Specialized knowledge or...
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I think that in this case...
How can... There's 2.1 billion Gmail accounts in this world.
I did not know that, Your Honor.
yeah, billion with a B. How can it be harder than normal and require specialized knowledge to set up a Gmail account?
Yeah, I don't think that is the act in and of itself of setting up the Gmail account, or I think it's a Ymail account, that is the sophisticated means in this case. What I think it is the use of that account to impersonate David Morgan.
That's the fraud.
Well, it's above and beyond the normal fraud, Your Honor, I think. This is additional fraud on the bosses of her company in order to try and hide the fact that she has made these.
Okay, so I've made a Gmail account and then I send an email from it. That's
right.
Complex?
She sent emails to them and then she's right. Represented to them conversations.
But how is that complex? Had. That's just lying. What specialized knowledge or complexity? Because, you know, that's what I'm wrestling with here. There's a standard in the guideline.
Yeah.
And this seems like stuff that, and getting a P.O. box, oh my gosh, anyone can walk in and do it. So there's nothing complex about the Gmail account or the Ymail account or the getting the post office. And now you say, well, but using them to lie is what made it complex?
Well, and like because she has the knowledge that the type of lies that she's telling her bosses will be ones that will cover up the scheme. I think she also
that's just covering up. Is every effort to cover up fraud complex?
So I think that what makes
when you cover it up, that makes it complex.
No, Your Honor, but I think that what makes it complex in this case is the additional steps that she took. You've already mentioned
the additional
some of them,
steps.
So
she, I'm sorry. But I think we can agree. I can give you the number of post office boxes in this country if you want, but I don't think it's going to help your case. So. And they're really, really easy to set up. So if it's not the setting up the post office box and it's not the setting up the fake Gmail account.
She sends a promissory note to the GMSI in the name of David Morgan, agreeing to pay back the money.
I get that she did these things to cover up. Why is that a complex thing to do?
I think the interlocking of all of these separate steps is the complexity.
Interlocking is just covering up.
I mean, I don't think that it's...
Okay. Well, I'll give you that it's complex. Now you have to tell me how it's especially complex, because that's the standard under the guideline. Tell me how that is. If we say that's complex, how is it especially complex?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that based on what we've already talked about, it's especially complex. And I don't know that it looks like you're not going to...
I'm puzzling. I haven't encountered this guideline before, so I'm really puzzling about what they mean by complex and intricate. We can sort of feel our way through that, but then they've got that especially complex and especially intricate, which I think were obviously deliberately put in there as modifiers on how complex and how intricate it needs to be. And that's what I'm really trying. And then, you know, there's no sort of verbal formulation that's given by anybody. The district court just says, well, she created a P.O. box, she got a P.O. box, she created this account and used it to pretend to be this person to cover up her fraud in one instance of the frauds that she did. And that's all I saw the district court relying on. And so if I had to write an opinion to explain how that meets the standard of especially complex or especially intricate, that's why I'm asking you these questions. How would you write that to say this is not just more than the norm? That would just be complex. Yeah. This is way beyond the norm. It is especially, it's beyond the norm of complex. How would you say that?
I think that I would point to the comment to the guideline. I think it's 9B, which says that, among other things, the creation of a fictitious entity to hide these fraudulent transactions.
But she didn't create an entity, she impersonated somebody. An entity is not a person.
So,
I mean, setting up an entity like a whole business or something, that probably does require more complex steps. But just lying and pretending I'm somebody else is not setting up an entity.
Well, she did, you know, set up or at least represent that there was an entity called David Morgan Rental Properties when she rented.
She said
it.
Did she set it up? Did she set it up? Did she do anything to set it up or she just said it existed?
So I agree that she did not set up, you know, formally file paperwork with.
Did she do anything to set it up or just lie?
I don't think that there was evidence that she did anything formal to set it up. But I think that...
Did she do anything informal to set it up?
Well, I mean, she did, in fact, represent that it existed.
Right, so she lied.
She lied about it. And she created documents that said that it existed.
How would you compare the level of sophistication to what was at issue in McCants?
I think that it is less sophisticated than McCants. I think that in McCants, there was more sophistication there. It was across jurisdictions. That was one.
Was this not across jurisdictions?
This was across jurisdictions. It's true. This was across jurisdictions. I think that there
district court didn't rely on that, though.
The district court
didn't rely on it.
Didn't explicitly say that in its decision. That's correct. But
there's no dispute that it was.
There isn't any dispute that it was, though. Well, actually, I think the defense at trial was that there was no venue because,
their whole argument was no interstate commerce. That's in fact true.
But the jury rejected that argument, mm-hmm. and there was, you know, sufficient evidence at this trial for that. That's not being challenged. Deal. So, but I do think McCants also says that even if you could imagine more sophisticated means of conducting the fraud, that doesn't mean that what happened in the particular case isn't sophisticated means that the enhancement doesn't apply. I would say, Your Honor, that I'm sorry, do you have a question, Judge Tatel? That Judge Tatel, in fact, brought up this point that the standard here isn't, you know, is really, it's, I think this court in Hunt said that it's really a factual finding by the trial.
This is not a factual finding. This is applying the, there's no dispute about the facts here. This is applying the guidelines to the facts. And these facts are not contested, at least at this point. That's why when I asked Mr. Hicks my questions, I asked him, isn't the proper standard due deference?
Yeah,
there's no fact finding.
I think I read Hunt to say that it's that essentially
right?
a question.
Isn't that right?
I think I read Hunt to say that it's essentially a question of fact. But I think that whether or not that merits a clearly erroneous standard or a abuse of discretion standard, whether or not essentially a question of fact meets that standard, not particularly. But I do agree that there is.
Are you arguing with me about this because you don't think you can prevail if it's a due deference standard?
No. I think that regardless of what standard we're talking about, there is deference owed to the trial court. And therefore, that the sentence should be. If there are no further questions from the court, I'd ask that this court affirm the convictions and sentence in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hahn. Mr. Hicks, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 3 quick points in rebuttal. First, as to the question of did the district court address relative probative value? And this is it. I know you have it from the other appendix. I'll give it to you in the JA, which is 130 and 131. That is the entirety of the district court's analysis as to both probative value and prejudice. It's very short, and the answer is no.
Is that the same? Are those the same pages?
I believe they are. It is. It's the July 21st transcript, but if you're looking for JA, it's 130.
Oh, got it. Thank you.
And the answer is no. It did not address the probative value in terms of the relative probative value in light of the undisputing of intent and mistake. So we think that is contrary to Old Chief. And the case is saying that you do look at the relative probative value. Second, and as I think I heard the government concede, the district court really didn't engage in a prejudice analysis other than to say, I don't think it's prejudicial because the money just wasn't as much as the first time around. And as we've said, that just doesn't seem like the right way that you approach the prejudice from a 404B of evidence. In addition, again, to all the other prejudice that we point out, that it was introduced for intent. It was similar in nature to the charged offense. It was right afterward in time, and it was extensive. It comprised over 60 pages. And if you're looking for that, it's at JA 172 to 232 is all of the evidence, the 404B evidence at trial. And then the last point I'll make, third, is I believe I did hear the government say that the sophisticated means here was allowed her to continue the scheme. And as we point out at page 40 of our opening brief, That's simply, you can't conflate the two. You can't conflate the sophisticated means with the fraud that is the underlying element. And
I thought there was a reference, the cases refer to sophistication in the execution of the scheme too. Is that not right?
I don't think it is. I'll give you what I think is the best case on this, which is the Fourth Circuit. Starts at page 20 of our opening brief. It says, because virtually all fraud will involve misrepresentation, the realm of especial complexities and intricacies involves more than the forgeries, misrepresentation, and concealment inherent in fraud. And I think that case is important to this point, not only for what it says, but it uses that word, especial, especially complex, especially intricate. And we're talking here, this added 15 months to the sentence. It increased it from 81 months to 96 months at the 25% increase. And you know, all for something that, boy, sure doesn't seem very sophisticated to me, much less especially sophisticated or complex or intricate.
The government said the promissory note made it complex.
I think the promissory note, if you go back and look at the promissory note, it was the opposite of complex. I mean, it was
It's better than that, right? It said the promissory note was done by the company lawyers once she told them that this guy wanted to pay the money back.
But I think
that's what the district court found. So she didn't even do the promissory note.
Yeah. I don't think it was the.
So it's hard for it to be complex if she didn't even do it. It's after she said the guy wanted to pay the money back, then the DMS lawyers drafted the promissory note.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I agree completely. And I think that, you know, for lack of a better word, the opposite of sophisticated would be somewhat ham-handed. And I think that that is not merit 15 additional months. There are no further questions.
No. Thank you, Mr. Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Hahn. Thank you, Judge Tatel.
We'll take this case under submission.